Can we start? Good morning, everybody. We are currently in the chapter on image reconstruction. In particular, we are considering computed tomography principles, abbreviated by CT. A very important technique that allows us to do 3D reconstructions from X-ray images. And in terms of the storyline of this lecture, so far we considered pre-processing algorithms. So what can we do with single images to enhance their appearance, and then we take multiple images and try to do a reconstruction from multiple images. That's where we are currently in. And the core of the computed tomography reconstruction algorithms, the core is Bayer's law. This is not associated with alcoholic beverages at all. That's the name of the guy who did that. And Bayer's law tells us that the observed intensity at a certain pixel is the original intensity that we observe at the X-ray tube. And then we have an exponential decay, fx, y, and we integrate over a line dl. And this can be reformulated as logarithm I divided by I0 minus is integral fx. Fx, y, dl. That means for each pixel in the image, we get a line integral through the function. Yeah. So what type of picture do we have in mind? If this is our xy space, if this is our object where each point here is an intensity value at position x and y, okay? Yeah. And if we consider the measurement, for instance, our detector is at this place, then we measure here I, we have here at our x-ray tube I0, and then the energy, the original energy, is reduced to energy I by this integral here, okay? Good. That's the X-ray attenuation law for a single pixel. Now let's continue. Let's call this integral value here p. Yeah? So p is the line integral over the two-dimensional function along a line. So again, we have p is integral fx y dl along a line. And on Thursday, we have introduced Dirac's delta function that has the value 1 if the argument is 0, and 0 if any other value is used as an argument. So we can rewrite we can rewrite this as a double integral fx y delta. And now we say that we consider only those points that sit on the line going through the origin. Now we look at these projection lines here, where this is the angle theta. This here is the, in distance one, this here is length one. This here is the sinus theta or sine theta. This is the cosine theta. And a point sits on the line that is defined by, let's say, let me draw it again in a better way. So this is the projection line, and this is the normal vector. And the normal vector we consider at the rotation angle theta. Okay, so you have the rotation angle theta, and here you have your sine theta and your cosine theta here. And it's clear that a point sits on the straight line if x times cosine theta sine theta is zero. Okay? Zero. It sits on this original line. So we can write here x sine, cosine theta plus y sine theta. And if the point xy sits on the straight line given by this normal vector going through the origin, then here we have a zero. If this is zero, then we have the delta function at point zero. The delta function at point zero is one. So we consider this function value. For all the other points where this is not sitting on the straight line, this factor is zero. So that tells us if we integrate fx times the Dirac delta over all x and y values, we end up with a line integral. That's the trick in this here. Yeah, we end up with a line integral. With a line integral. And if we look at P of S, or at the projection point at detector element S, this extends to fxy delta x cosine theta plus y sine theta minus S. And here we are. Dx dy. Yeah. That means if we have here our projection, these are the projection lines. Yeah. This is the projection. That's the projection line. That's the projection. Yeah. I always have to be clear about this. This is the rotation angle of the detector element. And if I want to have here, this is the detector element zero. So we have this integral at this point. And if we have the detector element at point S, we have to consider the straight line with an offset S. And that's why we add here the other component S, where this is here the equation for the straight line cosine theta sine theta x is s. Yeah? Sorry, I was a little confusing with the original sketch. Okay, good. So we understood that. And another thing that we should keep in mind is the discretization of the integral. You know that from school, and so let me just make a brief note on that. If you have here a function like this, and you have to compute the integral from x0 to x1, how do you compute the integral? Well, you can compute the if the function is given in analytic form, you can analytically compute the integral. But numerically, what you can do is you just define here small patches, and then you sum up these small patches, rectangular approximation, and then you get a numeric approximation of the integral. So if you have a function like this, integral fx dx from x0 to x1, you can also say this is a sum from I is 1 to n. If you have n of these stripes, and if all the stripes have the same width, you can write w times, and then the function height, f at position pi, where this here is the, how do I write this, pi. So this is p1, p2, up to pn, if you have n of these stripes. Yeah. So if they have the same width, you just multiply with the height given by the function value, and then you sum things up. Okay. And what does reconstruction now mean? Reconstruction means compute out of different p values and different line integrals the original function. Yeah? And here, if you go into the discrete, that means that you have a system of linear equations where this prefactor just tells you what is the width of your stripe that you are looking at, and this is the height. And if you have to compute the unknown function, you have to compute these function values at discrete points. And that's what we did last week here on the blackboard. And then we can continue in the text. Question? No question. So if you consider the simple situation that you have just four function values, let's call them x1, x2, x3, x4. And then you do the projection here, and you say this observation here, let's say it's, give me a number in between 1 and 10. 5. Give a number. No, a number. Do you have to look at the blackboard for finding a number?
No. Okay, just to give 4.
4? The problem was, and that was pointed out last time by one of our friends here, that this solution is ambiguous. So we need to have at the end a matrix that is regular. And by using random numbers, the probability is high that we will end up with a non-singular matrix. Okay? Give me a number in between, in between 0, 9, 10,
3.
Oh, very good choice. Very good. Very good.
8.
8. Good, thank you. And now we say the integral is 7. Yeah, the integral can be written as a sum. So what we can write here is the first equation is x1 plus x2 is 7. The second equation, the third one, and the fourth one, x3 plus x4 is 4. Then we have x1 plus x3 is 8, and x2 plus x4 is 3. This can be rewritten in terms of a matrix vector notation. So we have x1, x2, x3, x4 is 7, 4, 8, 3. Good. And now the matrix. Who gives me the first line? I don't speak German, in between 8:30 and 10. You can say it in German if you want, the second line. Yeah, right, it's okay, 1:1. And? 0:0. Okay, third row. Third row, sir. 1:1:0:0. Right. And four. So, now. So this is our matrix A. This is our vector X. And this is our observation P. So AX is P. And this matrix here, and that's interesting. This matrix is a 4x4 matrix. So we have 4 measurements and 4 projection rays and 4 unknowns. In nature, this will never ever happen that we have the same number of equation like unknowns. This is a very academic example, right? And to do the reconstruction, what do we have to do? And I'm not checking this, whether this is now a regular or a singular matrix. Let's assume this is a regular matrix and we can invert it. So the reconstruction is X A inverse times P. Yeah. So that's the CT, computed tomography, reconstruction result. Reconstruction result. And this matrix here, if I tell you, for instance, the first line or the second line, you know that the ray hits detector element 1, detector element 2, but not 3 and 4. If you read the third line, you see that the ray hits, not detector element, volume element, hits volume element number 1. Sorry for that. Volume element number 1, not 2, but 3, not 4. So in this here, we have encoded the projection geometry. Okay? So if you, for instance, know about the P matrix, and you know that you want to reconstruct a discrete 3D volume, you can compute a straight line given by the P matrix, and then you can decide which voxel is hit by the projection ray. And you just enter into the matrix a 1 if the ray projection ray hits a certain volume element, and a zero if not. So this here is a very special matrix. It encodes geometry. In this here, we see the projection geometry. It's encoded in there. And this matrix has a very special name. It's called the system matrix. So if you have a selected projection and you look for the system matrix, a selected volume and a selected acquisition scenario, and you look for the system matrix, you just compute this one here.
But the matrix will always be singular if you use that example, independent of the numbers.
Why?
Because you can't form the fourth row by the first and the third, and the matrix isn't defined by the numbers, but
all but by this equation, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, you're right. Stupid, I'm stupid, yes. You're right. Because this matrix is given by this, so this will be, again, singular. Perfect. Stupid. Yes. We cannot fix it, actually. We cannot fix it. We can only fix it by using a different viewing direction. That's right. Thank you for the pointer. Stupid. The system matrix is the same also with these numbers. You're totally right. Should have known this, seen this. Okay. The system matrix is the same. So we cannot compute the inverse. How would you solve the problem instead? It's a good point. How would you solve the problem instead? So once again, the observation, sorry for that, observation A is singular. A is singular. So what we can do is we can have a third projection. So acquire a third projection. For instance, we could do the following. We could acquire, for instance, projection like this, where we have here these two values, P1 and P2. And we end up with an additional line in the in the original matrix A, what is the additional line? If here is x1, x2, x3, x4, well, this is 0, 1, 1, 0. Okay? But now we have a 5 by 5. Did I do something wrong? What?
You have two lines.
I have two lines, yeah? X3 and X2.
Yeah, but you're not summing them up.
Yeah.
It's like it's two different rays. It's not.
Ah, okay. Stupid. Yeah,
flow.
That's right. That's right. I should have here six. Sorry. For each projection line, we get one equation. Thank you. I'm continuing like I did 2 weeks ago. Good. So we have a 6x4 matrix, and this matrix cannot be inverted. So how do you solve the system of equations? Well, how do you solve it? The answer is SVD, but what do you do in practice?
Solving a least squares problem.
Yes, solving a least square problem. So what you do is you multiply both sides with a transpose x. And then you can invert the Gram matrix that you should know from mathematics. Okay. So that's the least square estimate of the volume that we want to reconstruct. Good. So once again, together we have seen that this is a singular problem that has a non-unique solution. Together we have seen that it's independent from the measurements because the system matrix is defined by the geometry, and independent from the measurements, the invertibility of this matrix is given. And we have seen that we can do reconstruction by using SVD or computing the pseudo inverse of the system matrix. This is also called the pseudo inverse. Yeah, pseudo inverse. Is there anybody in the audience who does not know where to get this matrix from? Do you all see this? Yes? Yes? Good. If you have to solve the puzzle in practice, the problem size explodes. So we have in CT volumes of 512 by 512 by 512, and that's even a small volume. That means we have 130 million unknowns. 130 million unknowns, and you cannot solve this problem on a standard computer with the standard methods that you have learned in your math. So that's a very tough task. Good. A very tough task, and that means we will talk about alternative numerical methods to deal with this type of reconstruction problems. And now let's consider again what I summarized on the blackboard, and that's where we stopped last week here at this slide. We have line integrals. So this is our projection, our detector plane, our detector line here in the 2D, 1D case. This is our 2D function, fxy. So f at position xy gives us the density value, the physical density of the object. And here we have our projection line. Yeah, our projection line, this is the rotation angle here. This is, for instance, the normal vector of this line, and we can define this line by the normal vector cosine theta, sine theta, times xy has to be equal to s, where s is the position on the detector element. Yeah? That's the notation we are going to use in the following. We look at the detector element position s for a rotation angle theta. Yeah? So if I have the 1D situation, I rotate around the patient, I have the rotation angle, and then I have the positions on the detector, S is 1, S is 2, and so on. Okay. So if I give you a S theta pair, you know how to get the data. You look for the rotation angle theta, and then you look at position S on the detector at the measurement. And this measurement is given by the line integral. Here we have denoted it by the Dirac delta function, fxy and the Dirac delta function. So what happens to a point? And that's interesting. If I do just a projection of a single point, let's think about this in more detail. Think about this in more detail. is this thing always falling asleep? So let's think about the following. We have our detector that goes around the object, and we have the line integral. That also means that we can look at the detector sitting here in the center, right? It's the same if we have the line integral. We can move around the detector and say we integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity, and it doesn't matter where the detector sits in space. So these are our detector elements. And what I can do is I can build a so-called sinogram. Sinogram that is a 2D image where here I have my S and here I have my theta. And I enter here as a line in the image P of theta S. OK? So let's look at the sinogram. If we project a point in the rotation center, how does the image look like? Well, if I project a point in the center onto the detector lines, I see that it always is at the same position as on the detector, independent from the rotation angle. So I will end up with an image like this. Yeah. Here we have all zeros and here we have ones. If the point sits in rotation center. If the point sits here, what happens? What happens? Well, this here is for rotation angle 0. So the point is here for rotation angle 0. Then we have the second rotation angle. We project orthogonally. So this distance here is smaller than this one. So the point moves into this direction. And if I take the next projection, the distance is even getting smaller. And if I'm here at this point, at this rotation angle, this point is projected to the center. This point is projected to the center. And if I move away, so let's say this direction here, it's negative on the negative side. So it's getting here. And overall, the point will generate a sinusoid curve. Yeah? If you look at a point and at different projections, the point will move towards the center, move towards the negative, and then it will come back. Okay? And if I have another point, let's say this one here, I get another sinusoid function, yeah, like this one here. And if I have a point here, somewhere in space, I get another sinusoid function. And if I have a point here, I get a sinusoid function like this. And then I get many of these sinusoid functions. And reconstruction means convert the image of these sinusoid functions to the original image. And this is called sinogram because points are mapped to these sinoid curves. And what you can do now at home, use MATLAB. And if you have the image processing package, there is a function implemented, it's called Sinogram, and then you can upload the image of your girlfriend or of your boyfriend, and you can compute the Sinogram. Yeah? And reconstruction means compute out of the line integrals the original image. That's reconstruction. Okay, good. And that's also shown here. We have a point, we project it here. We get this value on the detector element. And if I move around, I get this sinusoid function. And it's really an art. I mean, even if you have just point configurations, by looking at the sinogram and then decide where the points are in space, that's something that is not so easy to see. You need a lot of experience. At least I cannot read sinograms. I look at sinograms and I have really start to work hard to get a good idea what the three-dimensional structure of the points was. Okay? Sinograms, sinusoid functions. Here is, again, the reconstruction problem. We have our projection values. We have our system matrix defining the geometry. And here we have our solution vector. And what we have to solve is this system of linear equations. And this can be done by standard numerical algebra, linear algebra. And again, here you see it's the inverse that has to be computed. This matrix is not inverse. Nobody has noticed this so far. And I think this example is even stolen from the book we took the basic concept of. So this is something we need to fix. And the common problem size, again, we want to reconstruct volumes of size 5/12 to the power of 3. So this is the set of unknowns. Again, do the computations. Five twelve to the power of three is 2 to the power of 9. To the power of 3 is 2 to the power of 27. Okay. 2 to the power of 27. How much is this? This is 2 to the power of 7 times 2 to the power of 20. 2 to the power of 20 is 10 to the power of 6, roughly, right? So this is identical. And now we have 2 to the power of 7 is 128, if I'm right, yeah? Times 10 to the power of 6. 130 million, yes?
Yeah, but we have very often zeros in the rows, so we can use column row storage or something like that, so we reduce the problem.
Yeah, but it doesn't change the number of unknowns. You have zeros if you have a typical Franconian guy like me in the scanner, then you have a lot of zeros, but usually it's a dense object we have to reconstruct. You mean the computing the inverse of the matrix?
Yes.
You can, of course, apply concepts that make use of dense matrices, of course, but that's not what we are currently considering. We are considering the number of unknowns first. Yeah, so we have to reconstruct the volume where my brain sits in. Yeah, the volume, and this has 512 by 512 by 512 samples. Okay, and then we have an image let's say we work with 512 images. That means we have here an x-ray tube and we look through the volume, and this here is 512 by 512. Okay, 512 by 512. So This is 2 to the power of 9 times 2 to the power of 9 is 2 to the power of 18. And this is roughly 256 times 10 to the power of 3. Yeah? So 250,000. Samples. Yeah. So here we measure an intensity value, and each value gives us an equation. Okay. And then let's say we have projections. Number of projections, and let's assume we have 512 projections. Yeah. We have 512 projections. So roughly 500 projections. And then we can compute the size of the matrix. Here the rows are the number of unknowns. Yeah, the number of unknowns, and the columns are the number of measurements. If you multiply these things together, and I did it already here using powers of 10, so it's easy to get a rough understanding. And what you end up with are memory requirements of 65,000 terabytes. Go to MediaMarkt or Saturn and go and buy a terabyte hard disk. And you need 65,000 to be able to store this. Yeah. It's amazing what the size here is we have to deal with. Yeah. It's amazing. Good. Here again, one image that should support your inspiration and your intuition and imagination about CT reconstruction. Once again, if you have here your rotation center, here your detector elements and your project, and where the point is you get a higher value, you can move around the object and you see where the projected point is moving on the detector. Yeah, it's moving forward and backward and forward and backward. Okay? On this sinusoid function. On the other hand, now you can think about approaching reconstruction intuitively, saying, what I do now is I just take the projection value and the associated projection line. So if I have here my image plane, I select one pixel. With each pixel, we have a projection line, yeah? An X-ray projection line with each pixel. So if I measure here the value 5, I could say this projection line contributed 5. And I can put in all the volume elements that are hit by the ray the projection value 5. And then I go to another pixel that goes differently, the associated projection ray goes differently through the object, and here I measure the value -7, and then I add up to each detector element the value -7. And if you have this binary situation here, where you have here zeros, and here you have one, and here zeros, you can smear the ones through the volume. So these points here that are originally zero will have one as a value, but the point where the projection rays intersect have the nice property that these values accumulate. So you will end up by just using the simple idea, take a value and smear it over the volume, additive, and smear it over the volume. At those points in the reconstructed object where the lines intersect, these values will accumulate. Yeah. So you see, by this simple back projection idea, you get some kind of information about the structure of the object. by just smearing things back. Of course, here in the neighborhood, you will get higher values. So you will get something like a Gaussian. Will look like a little bit like a Gaussian. Here you have a maximum. And then the values go down the farther you're away from the structural point. So what do we expect? We expect a reconstruction result that shows the structure but is smeared. So what you can do now is, with this idea, do the following. Take the picture of your boyfriend, compute with MATLAB a sinogram, and then just use the projection, parallel projection geometry, and smear the lines of the sinogram through a 2D plane and try to reconstruct. And at the end, you will see your boyfriend or girlfriend in a blurred manner, but you see the structure without being required to solve such a huge system of equations here. Yeah. And we will see, once again, if you look at this, this is the projection. And doing the smearing process is nothing else but computing A transpose P, which is this here. This process, if you look what's going to happen here, you just project here P on the columns, on the columns of the matrix A. And this is the result you see, and the final object you will get if you have a post-processing operation here, applying the A transpose A inverse on this final result, and then you will get a brilliant reconstruction result. So that's here this hat that you get around the point you want to reconstruct. It's not really a Gaussian, but it just follows the intuition that the point you want to reconstruct gives you the highest value, and the farther you are away, the more the signal drops down. Okay? That's the reconstruction by just doing back projection, by just smearing the projections according to the projection geometry through the function that you want to reconstruct. That's cool. And what you could also now think of is, you can now do a pre-processing in a way that you only have, or that you end up here with a sharp peak, and the points around the sharp peak of the point, they are weighted negatively, such that you have the effect that you have a good reconstruction, and the points around the object, they are more or less annihilated. And the question is, how can you, or how do you have to manipulate the projection data that you end up with a reconstruction result where here you have the entry for the point and the rest is zero? And this is, and we will see this today, this is a filtering operation. So CT reconstruction algorithms today in CT scanners do nothing else but take the projection image, do a filtering. This filtering does nothing else but modify the signal in a way, if you smear things back, you end up with clear structures. So find coefficients here that you end up with clear structures, and then smear all the projections through the volume you want to reconstruct, and then you are done. Yeah? And this is an alternative way to solve this huge system of linear equations that we have considered in the alternative mathematical setup. And this is the reconstruction result you get if you use these modified projections. And this is the back projection process. So we have here our line integrals, and now we take them and smear them back. And this is here given in the animation. So this is the example result, and now we smear it back. So we take the 5 and the 7. Where did I put my pointer to? Yeah. I would never ever have been able to find it. So we smear it back. So we have 5, 5, 4, 4. Okay? And now we take the second one. We smear it back. 7, 2, and then we add up these two and accumulate it. Okay? And it's clear if we have a single point, the single point where all the rows intersect will show a high value, and where all the others do not necessarily intersect, and you just accumulate here the contributions. So you end up with this reconstruction result. That is wrong, actually. But you see here, higher value, lower value, and these ones are rather similar. If you look at the original setup here, higher value, lower value, and this one, rather similar. Yeah? So somehow the structure comes back, even with just two projections. The structure comes back up to scaling. Yeah, and it's mirrored, and it's low-pass filtered. Yeah, but it's telling us intuitively that we get information on the object that we observe in the projections. Okay, and if you want to see how things smear, you see if you look at the math that you just have to multiply the projection by the transpose of the measurement matrix. But this is not an inverse. This is not an inverse, but it's just an intermediate step to get the right solution for the system of linear equations. Yeah? It's an intermediate step. And now you also see that linear equations and inverse of matrices and multiplications are closely related to signal processing, and that you can, solve many of these problems by using signal processing technology. Okay. Good. In terms of integral notation, what's back projection? Back projection means you sum up over all the considered rotation angles for a given line. Here, that's the normal vector of the given line, cosine theta, sine theta. And you integrate here the projections over the rotation angles. Yeah? So we rotate the detector by rotation angle theta, and then we integrate over all the rotation angles. We smear things back. And that's characterized here in the back projection step. Good. It's also important to say that you can rotate from 0 to 2 pi, but you have to make sure that you have the proper weighting at the beginning, because it doesn't matter whether you travel from the X-ray tube to the detector this way, or if the X-ray tube is on the other side and you travel this way. Yeah? So you get twice the contribution if you take the projection from this direction and that direction. That's why we have here the factor 1/2. Usually rotation around the object for 180 degrees is sufficient. For 180 degrees is sufficient, because if I have parallel projections, the lower part does not contribute new measurements. They are identical. Doesn't matter whether the photons travel from this side or the other way around, whether I X-ray from this side or I X-ray from this side. It's commuting. Yeah? Okay? It's commuting. Why is the picture so corrupted? A short history of CTs. For instance, in CT scanners, let's see where we are. This is a CT scanner where the cover is removed, and you see here the X-ray tube, you see here the detector elements, and the whole thing is rotating around the object. Yeah? And the first CT scanners, they were not using here an X-ray focus and this bundle of non-parallel projection beams. They have used one projection beam, and then they rotated around the object with one projection beam. Yeah? And then you can move the X-ray source and rotate, and you can deal with the parallel projection beam geometry. So that was what initial scanners have had in terms of acquisition geometry, parallel projection geometry. And the advantage of the parallel projection geometry is in terms of the reconstruction algorithms that they are way simpler than for perspective projection geometry, as you can imagine. Okay? So the principle was rotate around the object and translate things. Translate the table to get step by step the slices, and translate the X-ray tube to get the parallel projection beams. That's what they did in the 70s. Yeah? So the first CT scanner was built 1971 at EMI. You know what EMI is? What type of company? EMI Records. They built these plates where you could play music, yeah? Langspielplatte. EMI Records. Do you have an idea why not General Electric, Philips, or Siemens invented and built the first CT scanner? You know what the reason was? It's a nice story. It's a very interesting story. Go to www.nobelaward.se and read the text that was written by the inventors of the CT scanner. They got the Nobel Prize in 1979. And you know what the reason was that the CT scanner was invented? It was the Beatles. The Beatles, they made so much money with their song, with their music. So EMI, they built, they had a contract with the Beatles, so they sold all the records and they made a huge amount of money. And so the management of this EMI Records told the engineers, hey, we have so much money, so we are willing to invest in crazy ideas. So send us proposals, and if you have a good idea, we will give you money to do some research on that, besides your daily work. And that what happened. The inventors of the CT scanner sent a proposal to the management, said we think we can, you know, do a 3D reconstruction of objects using X-ray scanners, and then they got the Beatles money to build the first scanner. That's why a music company invented the CT scanner. Yeah, and that's not something I'm telling you. You can read this all over in the web. Of course, you can say everything was ready to build the system, but they actually did it, and they did it with the money of the Beatles. Yeah? So if you see next time Paul McCartney, you know that he is not only creating very enjoyable moments in terms of listening to music, but he did also a very important contribution to medical imaging, indirectly. That's a cool story, yeah? So if I have to entertain people, sometimes I give talks about the Beatles and their impact on medical imaging or something like that. And then people come, hundreds of people come, and they have no idea what's this about, and then I just tell the three sentences and then I do all the math. That's how you generate an audience to listen to you. But it's a nice story, and just go to the Nobel Prize web pages and read the speeches of the winners in 1979. It's a very interesting story, and I mean, you no longer pay tuition, but in practice, you can tell your dad tonight about this, and he might be excited, yeah? As well. Yeah, it might be worth sitting here. Good. The first CT scanner, the acquisition took 5 minutes. The acquisition, yeah? That means it took 5 minutes to acquire the data. You know how long it takes to get a full body scan in a modern CT scanner nowadays? Less than 30 seconds from acquisition to the final reconstruction result. Here it already took 5 minutes to acquire one slice in the brain with a spectacular resolution of 64 by 64 pixels. Yeah, actually you saw nothing, but it was worth. The reconstruction took 30 minutes because you had to solve these huge algebraic problems, meaning the system of linear equations. And actually, the first CT scanner was doing a brute force linear algebra approach, because all the smart algorithms that we are going to discuss until Christmas haven't been known at that point. And the resolution was 80 by 80, 64 by 64, roughly around that. I think 64 by 64. Good. Then people started to think about the typical practical scenario. You have your X-ray tube, and the X-ray tube releases a bundle of X-rays, and you have your X-ray focus, and you can say that the X-ray acquisition setup is very much similar to projective geometry. The projection rays intersect at the focal point or at the X-ray focus, and then you have your bundle of projection rays going through the patient and hitting the detector. Yeah, so here is a typical setup for a CT scanner. They work with a fan beam geometry, that's how it is called, in one plane, a bundle of projection rays. These systems became available in the middle of the 70s, so 1 year after we won the world championship in soccer. So let's see what's going to come next year for us. It took 20 seconds per size, per slice. And then fast rotations became possible in 1987 because the slip rings were invented. I mean, or were used for CT scanners. I mean, think about the following situation. You want to rotate around the patient and you rotate the whole equipment. You do not do what the guys at Fraunhofer are doing in their industrial scanners. They have a fixed X-ray tube, a fixed detector, and then they have a turntable and they rotate the object. Yeah, I mean, think about having me sitting on a turntable, yeah, rotating three times a second, yeah, and all the electronics is rigid and in place, static. You cannot rotate the patient, yeah. Even if you think about Oktoberfest and all the devices for rotating things in some devices, yeah. But that's not what we want to do. So in medicine, in medical applications, the constraint is the device has to rotate. And if you have to rotate the device, you have to make sure that you get the data out, that you get the electricity in to run the device. And to have this link, you need cables, yeah. So you have a cable, and the cable is also somehow dealing with the rotation and following the patient. And with a slip ring, you have a mechanism where you can replace the cable by some contacts in the device, yeah? And then things can rotate without having a cable to follow. You just have the transfer of electricity and data transfer using these slip rings, yeah? And with that, you're able to do fast rotations, and nowadays we are in a range where we have one rotation in 300 milliseconds, so we get more than three rotations within a second around the patient. And you can imagine what type of power is in there under the cover. Yeah. Sometimes you might think if patients would know what's happening below the cover, they would not go into this device. But on the other hand, if you think about the physics, where is the safest place in the situation? It's in the device. Yeah. So it's a good choice to sit in the center of the device. Yeah. If something breaks in here, nothing is going to happen. It's all happening outside. So it's a good choice. The technician should basically sit with the patient within the scanner to be safe. Yeah. Okay. And then it started 15 years ago. Fan beam geometry was replaced by cone beam geometry. We left the range of one detector line. And we said we have a detector, a two-dimensional detector, and here is our X-ray source, and the X-rays go in a fan structure in the plane, but the fan is going up and down, so all the detector elements, they get some values. And at the beginning of the century, vendors started to increase the number of detector line and use this as a marketing feature. For instance, you could go to the big conferences and conventions, and then they tell you, we have 8 detector lines. Yeah? Wow, 8 detector lines. Yeah? The other vendor has just 4. We have 8. And next year, 32. We have 32. And then the other company was running with a button, 2 × 32 = 64, and that's what we have. Yeah. So it took 4 or 5 years, and then they had the full-size detector, and nowadays nobody is talking anymore about the number of lines on the detector. And there were really very crazy ideas implemented, but very effective ideas. For instance, companies built a spring focus. So what they did is, instead of having a detector with 64 instead of 32 lines, they had an X-ray tube where this focus could be moved up and down. Yeah. So if you move the focus up, of course, you have different projection lines and you get additional information on the detector elements. So you get additional line integrals. You get more data, and more data means better image quality. And all these smart ideas were implemented. The spring focus was also implemented in one of the early CT scanners. I just told you, rotation around 180 degrees is sufficient. If you go the other way around, you get redundant data, yeah, because these are the data you already measured. So what they did in the early days also, they just said, I have a 180 degree rotation, and then I spring with a focus, and I have another 180 degree rotation, and I get additional line integrals for the 180 degrees. Below. And many of these ideas were generated. The core concept is basically this image. Yeah, this image tells you there is an X-ray focus, there is a projection ray and a detector element. And if you want to get better image quality, you need more line integrals. You need different projection geometries, different line integrals. And whether you change something here on a detector or whether you move around the X-ray focus, that basically, from a mathematical point of view, doesn't matter. Here, another CT scanner, and this is an image we stole from Toshiba because we don't want to be too biased regarding the local vendors here. They pretty much look all the same with this donut shape structure. Yeah, and if you look at these marketing pictures, you always have kids and nice young girls and women. And in practice, it's very different. And sometimes also here, this diameter is not sufficient. So one direction of developing CT scanners is also considering making the whole of the CT scanner wider and bigger, because we have nations where the standard CT scanners are not sufficient for many patients. Yeah. So that's also a task. Okay. Good. Then this was one invention done by our local vendor. So they were thinking about, okay, I have the gantry. A gantry, that's the device where the X-ray tube and a detector moves. We want to acquire more data. And then they have noticed, well, if I put the X-ray tube here and the detector here, I have some space in the gantry here and here. Why don't I go with a second X-ray tube and a second detector into the X-ray scan? And this was something that was introduced roughly 10 years ago, so not so long ago. And you can acquire the same time 2 orthogonal projections, basically. 2 orthogonal projections. You can acquire more data by one rotation. That helps a lot for reconstructing moving objects like the heart. So this increased the quality of coronary or cardiac imaging. And what you have to be aware of if these two X-ray tubes fire the same time. Yeah, these X-ray particles come and there is a high chance that they hit each other and then you have scattering. So they are synchronized in a way that they are acquiring images at different moments or different time points. So they are synchronized. That's a very tough engineering task. And you can run these two X-ray tubes with even with two different energies. And we know that the attenuation properties of objects depend on the energy of the X-ray photons that you send through. And having here simultaneously reconstructions with different energy levels, you can conclude something about the material that was sitting in the scanner. So you can do a material decomposition in scanners like that. And this is important, for instance, if you have stenosis in the heart. Yeah? If you have a stenosis in the heart, there are different types of plaques that sit there. There are so-called heart plaques that are calcified. They just do not allow the blood flow as it should be, but most probably nothing is going to happen. And there are vulnerable plaques. These are plaques, they can break, and then they release particles, and these three particles go in the blood. They are in the blood flow, and at some point where the vessel gets thinner and thinner, you have a blockage, an occlusion of the vessel. And if you have plaque of this type, then something has to be done, because otherwise you are a high-risk heart attack patient. And what doctors want to do, they want to classify the type of the plaque that is sitting in the vessel. Is it a calcified plaque or is it a vulnerable plaque? So you need material information. And that's something you do not get out of the standard scanners. And with this one, we are getting closer to this type of plaque classification, but we are not yet there. But that's also an open problem. Yeah? Patient comes, has a stenosis, and if it's calcified, you can say, well, you know, you have a certain age, and according to your age, you can live with that. That's okay. We should control it once a while, but there is no high risk. And if you have this vulnerable plaque, it can happen that you go for running or you have some exciting moments in your life and then it breaks and then you have a heart attack. Yeah? And this is something that should be avoided, of course. That was a very, very rudimentary explanation from a medical point of view. I hope that my colleagues from the medical school are not watching this video. I'm not sure how precise I was, but that's the core idea. Let's say it's good enough for an engineer to get an idea why this might be important. Okay, we can agree on that. Good. And if you have a good dentist, these systems are nowadays also at your local dentist. So you go in there, you put your head here, it's fixed. You have here your X-ray tube, you have here a detector, and then this C-arm type of scanner rotates around your object, rotates around your head, and then you get a 3D reconstruction of your head. Yeah. And it's interesting, in dentistry, they don't call it CT, computed tomography. They have a different name for it. I don't know how they call it, a weird name. Digital volume tomograph. Yeah. And then you say, it's a CT. No, it's not a CT, it's something different. But basically, here is an X-ray focus. Here is a detector, here is your projection geometry characterized by a projection matrix, and then you capture X-ray images. You know each pixel represents a line integral, and out of the line integrals, the nice computer sitting next to the scanner is doing the 3D reconstruction. Okay. It's heavily used nowadays, in particular for patients that get a implant. For an implant, you have to make sure that you drill a hole and in there, and that you do not drill too much, because there is an important nerve going through the bone. And this nerve, if this is injured, then your face will be dead in terms of feelings. Yeah, so they get very close to this nerve, so they need a very good understanding in their planning of the implant, where the nerve is and how deep they can drill into the bone to put in the basis for the implant. And nowadays with the 3D scanners, they can be as close as half a millimeter to the nerve. They build drill templates. They are automatically built out of the CT scans, and then they just put in the template and drill, and then the hole is done, and then they move in the device, and then it's perfectly done. And it's for the patient, it's a great planning device with a huge impact, because before they had to do surgery, they had to remove the soft tissue and then look at the bone, and then they did some surgery, and now they just take it as is. They do they use their drill template, drill a hole, put in the device, and then it's done. There is not much blood, and the recovery time is excellent. I never got that, but a good friend of mine is a dentist who is specialized on this, and he's very excited about this technology. It's very, very exciting technology. Here is another CT device. This is a C-arm device. They don't have the slip rings, they have the cable still, so you don't have 360 degree rotations. There is the X-ray tube, there is the detector. They rotate around the patient, and here the C-arm is mounted to an industry robot system. That has various degrees of freedom, and you can rotate on arbitrary trajectories around the object and do 3D reconstructions. People are always excited about this robotic device. All the robotic software, by the way, is written now by a former PhD student of our lab. He's doing all the programming of this device. And there's also a nice story. I mean, if you look at the organization of big companies, you might think about the innovation process. And if you follow up how this invention came up, it's very interesting to learn that basically the head of engineering of this division within Siemens was a former Siemens employee in Augsburg. Augsburg, there is KUKA, the robots industry company, and a good friend of him had a beer with him, and then they said, he was saying, hey, you are working now for medical, why don't you use our robots for medical? And he said, well, we are just doing the C-arm devices. I have no idea what we could use a robot for. And then they said, oh, let's mount a robot, a C-arm device on a robot, and let's see what we can do. And that was the birth hour, without having an innovation team and all the innovation processes. It's just beer. Beer's law makes it. Sometimes the good ideas grow at points where you didn't expect it. And that's also the interesting thing of our life. Yeah. So you meet people, you talk to people, you have food with people, you meet interesting people, you discuss. At some point you come up with really cool ideas and cool inventions. Yeah, so it's also a nice story that just tells us innovation doesn't happen where you expect it to happen, and innovation cannot be planned. Yeah, you can prepare the environment, but you cannot plan for innovation. This is a modern system that is used in a neuroradiology department, a stroke unit, where you get stroke patients in. Usually you have the two planes. Remember, X-ray tube, detector. Hey, that's also a situation we had in this dual source CT device. This systems like that are used for a long, long time already in interventional radiology, and they use the 2D planes, the two 2D planes, to get two different views through the patient at the same time to get some 3D impression. Because if you have two views from different directions, you have a good understanding of the structure. And they use the two planes here just to get two orthogonal or whatever images to get a good understanding of the 3D structure while they are doing something with the patient. And What's not yet existing is, for instance, a system that uses this plane and this plane for acquisition, and then you have a simultaneous rotation around the patient for 3D reconstruction. That's something where I have a patent for. It's 12, 13 years old already, and I'm eager to see whether this is going to come one day, and I'm pretty convinced that this might be a good idea for the future. Good. So, further readings. I strongly recommend Larry's book on medical image reconstruction, a conceptual tutorial. It's easy going to read. We linked the PDF on our webpage. Another book that is very good, and it's rather old. It was written in the 80s. It's by Kuck and Slaney, Principles of Computerized Tomography. And there you find all the basics on computerized tomography. You find the book in the web, by the way. You don't have to buy it. You will find the PDF. And you find all the math, all the signal processing required to understand the basics of computed tomography. There is also a book by my colleague from Lübeck, Thorsten Butzuk, on computed tomography from photon statistics to modern modern cone beam CTs. It was published in English a few years ago. The first version was even German, so you might also find a German version of the book if you're interested in. And Willy Kalender, who is very famous for his inventions in computed tomography, a colleague here at Erlangen University, he also wrote a book several years ago on computed tomography. And this is less mathematical like all the others. It's more a book where you get the basic ideas and also learn a lot about the medical applications of computed tomography. So which one would I read in your situation? I would just focus on this one here. In combination with this lecture, this one is the best choice. Yeah, and it's for free, and you have the PDF. Okay? Larry's book is totally fine and totally sufficient for the following. Good. Just wipe the board. And now we will look into the reconstruction math in more detail, okay? It's about Fourier transform, one-dimensional, two-dimensional, forward, backward, up and down, like crazy. But at the end of the day, we will have very simple algorithms for reconstruction. So let's reconsider the concept of Fourier transform. So if I have a signal or a function P of S, its Fourier transform is given by this complex integral. You have heard this hundreds and hundreds of times already. Okay? You all know intuitively what the Fourier transform does. It does nothing else but transforming the function into a frequency domain, and the Fourier transform tells us something about the different frequencies in the signal. We know all periodic functions can be represented as a linear combination of sine and cosine functions. Yeah, so that's the direction where this idea comes from. So we can transform our signal PS into a function dependent on the frequencies. Here you see 2 pi omega. I'm personally quite often skip the 2 pi and encode it within omega, but that's your personal taste, what you prefer. We have just copied the notation of Larry's book, not to confuse you too much. But I personally, I don't care about these constant factors. Okay? And if you want to compute the original function given the Fourier transform, you have to apply the inverse Fourier transform. Here a prefactor is actually missing. And the inverse Fourier transform is again a Fourier transform where we just flip the sign of the exponential function. In terms of algorithms, there's no much difference. Yeah? Forward, backward Fourier transform is just a Fourier transform. Yeah? And we call PS and P omega Fourier pairs. Fourier pairs. And the convolution theorem, that's something I already explained to you. The Fourier transform has nice properties. The convolution of two signals corresponds to the product of its Fourier transforms. That's a property that we have to be aware of from the from now on, yeah, for the following discussions. So if you see a product of two Fourier transform, if you see a product of two Fourier transform, your bell in the outer shelf of your brain is ringing like crazy. Bing, 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 bing. That means it's a convolution in spatial domain. Yeah? We will require this bell in a few, no, on Thursday. So remember this, and on Thursday we will use the Fourier transform, the projection geometry, forward projection, line integrals, put everything together, and we will come up with a smart CT algorithm that is actually the working horse of today's CT scanners. Thank you very much, and we quit at this point. Have a nice day.